And he said, yeah, I don't think we want to do that. Anyway. He says, why don't you come up with something else? So I said, how about Emma Smith? And so I started working on Emma Smith, and because I thought that'd be good. And he says, then he calls me a couple months later, and he says, I think that's too churchy. We don't want to do church under stuff. So I said, how about George Patton? So I start working on George Patton. Thought that'd be great, because my dad, we love the movie Patton in our family, I guess. And so anyway, he calls Chapman, then calls me about 3 months later and says, look, we've had too much war stuff. We can't do war. So he says, why don't you do Warren Buffett? So here I am. And this was a good subject. I appreciated the opportunity to do this and to learn PowerPoint. I'm just going to... Now we have until about quarter after, is that right? Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm just going to go and we'll tell you about Warren Buffett, tell you about his life. He is known as the Oracle of Omaha or the Snowball. Well, maybe we'll get to the point where we talk about why they call him the Snowball. I'm just going to go through some of his early life adventures, and we'll learn about him. He was born in Omaha, Nebraska on August 30th, 1930. He's 88 years old now, to Howard and Lila Buffett. He was a middle child, two sisters. His family was very influential in Omaha. In fact, one of his grandfathers started a grocery store there in 1869. Now, most of my learning about Warren came from this book called The Snowball. And you look at people and you say, why do they turn out the way they do? Or why do they succeed? And we're going to find that a lot of it is based upon their childhood experiences. And Warren had a very, very difficult mother. She was just not too kind oftentimes to him and his two sisters. In fact, to the point where he, a lot of times, as a young child, did not come home from school, just went to other homes. His mother was just kind of hard on him. And that sort of led to some of the success, I think, that he had later on. There's a picture of Warren at age two. And
it's not the speech you give on Mother's Day,
yeah. Well, I think I don't know exactly what his mother's situation was. I think she had kind of a temper, and maybe she had some of her own frustrations in life. But even this picture, this is a photo of here's Warren. He's got an older sister, and they talk about the fact that picture dates at that point. Two older ones, neither of them seemed too happy. And they just had a challenging childhood, challenging family situation. Now, Warren's father was a financial guy, and he worked at a bank. He did some, he was somewhat of an investor. Here's a picture of Warren in the late 1940s. He's playing the ukulele, and he's got his... got his casual tennis shoes on. Now, some of these slides are a little bit out of order. I'm going to come back to his youth in just a minute. Here's another picture of him playing the ukulele. Now, Warren, I'm going to come back to this in a minute. Okay, so Warren is a young entrepreneur. He started out selling packs of gum, and he was at 6 years old. And the first, he had this huge desire to make money. He had this little box of gum and candy that he kind of hung around his neck. And the first, and he's 6 years old, and he's out walking around town selling candy and gum. And the first person who came up to him, a lady, said, I want one stick of gum. And he's 6 years old, and he says, no, I'm selling the gum by the pack. You buy the pack or you don't buy it at all. And so he, early on, had some entrepreneurial good sense. Then he started selling bottles of Coca-Cola. And he found that he could buy a case of Coca-Cola, and he could sell the Cokes and double his money. By the way, Warren Buffett is really big on Coke. If you go to China, you'll see, at least in the past, his picture is on the Cherry Coke bottle. And he drinks Cherry Coke. In fact, there's a story about him now. He says he's a very eccentric guy. And he has an interesting diet. He says the sweeter or the saltier, the better. And somebody asked him, well, why do you eat the way you do? Where'd you get this diet from? Because his favorite, he'll go to McDonald's, or he likes Cherry Coke. He likes potato chips, a lot of potato chips, things like that. He said that I did an actuarial study of who lived the longest and who had the best mortality rate. And he says, I found that six-year-olds had the lowest mortality rate. So I decided to eat their diet. And he's just a very eccentric guy. And he, so that's his diet. In fact, as another aside, even now today, now at one time, he was making, if you can believe this, he's one of the richest men in the world. At one time, he was making $33 million a day on his investments, okay? But even today, the story is that he says to his wife, Astrid, he says, how's the market, how'd the market do yesterday? How'd we do yesterday? And he's very frugal, so he will spend up to $3.17 on breakfast. He will not exceed that amount of breakfast. So he'll go to McDonald's, he'll decide he's got one of three choices. He'll either get two sausage patties if it's really been a good day, or two sausage muffins if it's really been a good day, because he can get those for $3.17 with tax. Or a couple of other lesser alternatives. But his wife will actually count out the exact dollars and change and give it to him in a little styrofoam cup. And then he gets in his Cadillac and he drives to McDonald's, and then he'll order exactly what he, you know, order the two sausage patties, whatever, and he'll have the exact change his wife's counted out. He'll give it to the lady. So, very interesting guy. Very eccentric. In terms of what drove him, and what things happened in his life that affected him and gave him a desire to succeed. Early on, about 1937, he's about 7 years old, his father, who worked at a bank, came home, and the Depression had found its way to Omaha, Nebraska. And his father comes home and says, bank closed, I no longer have a job. Now, even though the family was prominent in Omaha, they did not have a lot of extra money at that time, and they were really financially struggling. Now, to his credit, his father, who was a prominent man in town, went out and started a brokerage firm with another person, but they didn't sell much stock, and they weren't making much money. The family, a lot of their support came from Warren's grandfather, who would send money every month, and that's kind of how the family got by. But Warren had... from that age on, he decided he needed to be financially successful. That was really important to him. Now, he bought his first stock at age 11, three shares of Citi's service company. He saw the stock drop to $27 a share, and then it went back up to 40, and he sold his three shares and made a small profit. As I indicated, his father did start a small brokerage firm, and then his father in 1942 got elected to Congress, and so the family moved to Washington, D.C., and that's where they stayed until 1948. Now, let's see here. So then his next business venture was he had a paper route. This when he was in D.C. And he would sell the Washington Times and the Washington Post. And then, and this is when he was about 12 years old, I guess 13 years old. He had his own handwritten horse racing tip sheet that he sold to people. That's pretty remarkable for a 13-year-old. That year, he filed a tax return and wrote off his $35 bicycle that he was using. And then the next venture he got into was he and his friend found an old pinball machine, and they fixed up this pinball machine, and they took it to a barber in town, and they said, look, we've got this pinball machine. We'll split the profits with you. So put it in the back of your barber shop, and the people, while they wait for the haircuts, can play pinball. And they expanded that to, I think the first week, it was cost a nickel back in that day to play pinball. They expanded that to 8 or 9 pinball machines, and they started really making some pretty serious money for that at that time, renting out these pinball machines. He was very ambitious. He sold that business for $1,000 one year later. That was some pretty good money at that time. And then he continued to sell papers and wash cars. Now, by the time he graduated from high school, he had savings account of about $5,000, which would be equivalent to $50,000 in today's money. Now, at that time, he did not see the necessity of attending college. But his father, and apparently he had somehow had had an invitation to attend the Wharton Graduate School, because they were living in that area. And so his father put his foot down and said, no, you're going to go to college. And so he did go to Wharton for a year. Now, he...
For a year?
I think so. And then what happened was they moved back to Omaha. His father, and this was when Eisenhower was running, and his father backed the wrong candidate. So he lost. Who was running? I won't ask. But somebody's running against Eisenhower, and his father backed that person, and his father lost the race, the Congress race. So the family moved back to Omaha, and Warren then continued from the Wharton Business School. As I understand, he continued at the University of Omaha. Now, and he did graduate, and then he applied for Harvard. Now, by the way, he graduated from college before the age of 20. And then he thought, okay, and then he applied to Harvard Business School, and they rejected him because he was too young. So, let's see. Yeah, so he actually moved back to Omaha, and then he transferred to University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and he graduated in 1950, taking a huge class load. Now, there's a picture of his father when he was running for his last congressional race, which he lost. Now, his father then came back to Omaha, and his father got back in the investment business. Now, let's see. So he picked up this book after he graduated from college called The Intelligent Investor. And that was by a man named Ben Graham. And Ben Graham had this great investment philosophy, Warren thought. So Warren eventually enrolls in graduate school at Columbia University, Graduate School of Business. And this book by Ben Graham inspired Warren to enroll there. And Ben Graham was really famous for teaching and for investing in stocks that really had a good intrinsic value. Now, a lot of people buy stock based upon a hot tip. How many of you have ever had a hot tip for a stock? Okay, that's exactly, in many, Warren would say the wrong way to go about this, wrong way to buy a stock. So he bought stock. A lot of the stocks they bought were stocks that nobody else wanted. And Ben Graham taught his classes on how to value a stock. And you look at the book value, you look at what the company's actually worth versus stock price. And his idea was, it was all qualitative factors. You just look at the numbers. If that stock is not, if the stock price is not for under what the book value of the business is, don't buy it. So make sure you that business is worth every dime that the stock price is. And so then, and he would teach these classes at, it was actually night classes at Columbia University, and Warren would take these classes. Warren was the youngest member of the class, and he actually got the only A+ Ben Graham gave out. So then Warren, by this time, he's a young man. He returns to Omaha. He'd had the opportunity to attend Columbia University. So he comes back to Omaha, and his father has this investment firm. It's kind of a struggling firm. It wasn't the top firm in town or anything like that. But Warren starts working at the firm, and he's got these investment ideas that are pretty good. And people would come to him, and he was always willing to talk about what he thought was a good idea. But then he found that people were taking the tips he gave or the knowledge he gave, and then they would go to another broker in town and buy the stock that he suggested. So that was, gave away a lot of information. And then people, and this really bothered him that people would not buy from him because he was just too young. People just didn't have confidence necessarily that he was, that he knew what he was talking about necessarily. So the one thing that really happened great for Warren when he came back to Omaha, though, after being in school, when he was just still a very young investor, he met a young lady named Susie Thompson. And Warren was not, he wasn't the debonair type of guy. He was probably not a ladies' man. But the one thing he did have was great persistence. And Susie was a college co-ed. She was very popular, very attractive. And she had at least one other gentleman, or young guy, who really was interested in her. One other suitor, I guess they would call it. And her father was a prominent doctor in town. And Susie was a very, very outgoing person, very, very much a person who wanted to help other people. She was a private person, but she made friends fast. She was very personable. And Warren thought she was the greatest thing ever. So he really pursued her, and she was not that interested. And this went on for a couple years. Finally, her father really encouraged her to give Warren a chance. And so she started dating him a little bit, and eventually, once her father convinced her, father did not like the guy that she was going out with. One reason is because he was Jewish. Father convinced her to dump this guy, and then she starts dating Warren, and then the rest was history. They got married, and I'm going to read you, this is really interesting, what his wife says about him. In fact, she said, she felt he was a case, she said, and that for the moment she'd never seen anyone in such pain as this young man that she was going to marry. So anyway, they eventually got married. So now Susie's father did like Warren, but was certain he would not be a success. But he did tell Warren, always surround yourself with women. They're more loyal and they work harder. So Warren and Susie married in 1952, and she was his salvation. She did everything for him except support him. I'm going to read just a minute here. It says, Warren wanted a lot of things from his wife that you would ordinarily get from a parent. Not only that, he had grown up with a mother who did everything for him. Now Susie took over. Although their basic model of wedded life was typical of the time, he made the money, she took care of him, and covered the domestic front. Their arrangement was extreme. Everything in the Buffett household revolved around Warren and his business. In fact, he took his Moody's books on their honeymoon. He took a full stack of books on their honeymoon, the stock reports. He also arranged his schedule to give himself leisure time to play golf and ping pong, even signing up as junior member of the Omaha Country Club. Susie, barely 20 years old, was no Betty Crocker, but she had taken up rudimentary cooking and basic housekeeping like any 1950s wife. At a time when Omaha women were auditioning to appear on the show Typical Housewife on local station television station KTMV, she devoted herself to fulfilling her husband's few but specific requirements. Pepsi in the refrigerator, a light bulb in his reading lamp, some indifferently cooked version of meat and potatoes for dinner, a shaker full of salt, popcorn in the cupboard, ice cream in the freezer. He also needed help getting dressed, tenderness, head rubs, cuddling, hugs, and assistance in dealing with people. She even cut his hair because he claimed he was afraid to go to the barber. Warren was nuts about Susie and felt things about, and she felt things that were inside him, she says. She describes her role as his giver, his as the receiver. She was absorbing more about me and sensing much more about me than I was sensing about her, he says. And they were always seen kissing and cuddling. And 6 months later, she was pregnant with their first child. So that's a little bit about their interaction. And they have, so she was pregnant and she dropped out of the University of Omaha and had their first child. So there's a picture of them at their wedding. Now, they didn't, I don't know what happened to the $5,000 that Warren had when he graduated from high school, but by the time he was married to Susie, they didn't have much money. He, in fact, had to work, and he worked two jobs. And he wanted to teach at the University of Nebraska, but one problem is he didn't speak very well. So he actually took the Dale Carnegie course from Dale Carnegie. That's how far back he goes. And he began in their married life teaching night school at this college. Well, then his professor, Ben Graham, offers him a job in New York City. So Warren and Susan moved to New York City. And he works with... He works at Ben Graham, and he's hired to evaluate companies. Now, by this time, he's really starting to get his feet under him, and he got a lot of really valuable experience. And he spent literally, okay, now, how many of you ever seen the Moody's Manual, or what was the Moody's Manual? Any of you ever seen that? Okay. It is, at least at that time, it was 10,000 pages. Now, just to give you an idea of how much work Warren put into this, he read the entire Moody's Manual twice. And he was super dedicated. He always had his, even to this day, he always has his face in a book or a newspaper. In fact, one of the things he says about being successful is, he says he still spends 80% of his day reading. And if you want to be successful, read, read, read. But they would go around, and they would, Ben Graham, they were always looking for undervalued stocks and undervalued companies where there was value there, but people didn't know. On one occasion, there was an insurance company that sold a bunch of policies all over the Midwest, a life insurance company that sold all these policies to farmers and other people, and the company appeared to be just about insolvent. But what the people didn't know is that the Amundsen family had taken over this company. And so Warren went around to all these farmers and he bought their policies from them. And he bought their stock in this insurance company from them. And then the Amundsen family, having taken over this company, the company just blossomed and they made a tremendous amount of money on this. But he's always looking for undervalued companies. Now, he had a name for these companies he's looking for, and they would go out, they'd find a company that might be selling for $40 a share, but the company actually was worth, just on book value, just the value of their investment portfolio, $60 a share. They'd buy these companies up at less than their actual investment or book value. Now, Warren, Ben Graham was very much into just purely qualitative or quantitative factors. Just show me the numbers. Show me what the book value is. Show me what the earnings are. Show me what the stock price is. That's the way he did things. Warren was very much, he went along with that, but he very much wanted to know what the management of the company was. And he looked deeper, and he investigated much more carefully in terms of what the company's management was. Now, but there are these companies, you know, a cigar butt is something that like it's a, something that somebody's discarded, and maybe it only has a couple more puffs left. And that's what they would call these little companies they went after to buy. Now, as indicated, he was, in 1956, Graham dissolved this partnership that they were in. And at that time, Warren had increased his capital in just about 3 years from $9,800 to $140,000. So he was well on his way to financial success. Now, after this, Warren's got a capital of $140,000. He moves back to Omaha, and he sets up his own investment business. It's called Buffett Associates LTD. And this time, he's about 26 years old. He's a little wiser. So he tells people, so he says, I'm going to start investing money, and I'll start managing money, and I'm only going to do it for my family because I don't want to get sued. So he gets money from his aunt, and he gets money from a few relatives. Well, what happened was he started doing really well. And other people who invested with Ben Graham would find a way to come to Omaha and meet with Warren. And they'd say, hey, I've got $10,000. Take my $10,000. I don't care what you do with it. Just, you know, invest it for me. So Warren set up this partnership, and he had a new rule. He says, give me your money. He says, I'm not going to tell you what I'm investing it in. Don't bother me. He says, every once a year, we'll have an accounting. You can take your money and go, or you can. I'll keep managing it. But he says, I'm not going to tell you what I'm doing with it. And that was his rule. And few people ever opted out of him managing their money. And at this time, he's operating out of a little apartment, and he would do everything. He would type letters. He was doing all of the investigating the stocks. He would type letters. He did just everything. He did all the secretarial work. He collected the stock certificates and held them and put them in a safe deposit box. He was a one-man show. Now, within just a year, he took the $140,000 that he had from his capital from Ben Graham and increased it to $300,000. He was that successful, and he did charge people a fee to manage their money, and he reinvested all his fees. Now he's a young married guy, and he was super frugal. I mean, they lived on very little money. When he would go out of town to investigate stocks, he would not stay in a hotel. He would find a friend and stay in a bedroom. He was so, and even having $300,000 back in 1956, that's pretty, you're doing fairly well. His wife would, of course, get mail, and they would have these checks come in, and his wife would just not even open them, just give them to him. And one day she opened a check and found out that he had a dividend check for like $6,000. And she had no idea they were doing that well financially because they lived very, very modestly in all that they did. At the age of 27, he bought this home. I've got a picture of it. I'll show you. But he bought a home in Omaha for $31,000. Now, I guess that's a picture of Susie. I don't know if I showed you that already. He bought this home for $31,000. It's a three-bedroom home. He still lives in this home today. No, he still lives in the home. And he ran this partnership out of their bedroom in that home for many, many years. So he still lives in this $31,000 home, three-bedroom home. They call it Buffett's Folly. By 1962, this business he created had capital of $7.2 million, and he was a millionaire himself. His capital, which was $140,000 that he started out with, and then it went to $300,000, was up to $1 million. Again, he never sold his own, he never liquidated his own stuff, his own stocks. He just kept it all there. And all of this out of his bedroom. Now, that's when he became interested in acquiring a company called Berkshire Hathaway. And he became interested in them. He started acquiring shares of Berkshire Hathaway. Now, Berkshire Hathaway, for whatever reason, was a company that he thought he could really grow. And by 1969, he was doing very, very well. But he was finding the Vietnam War was coming on. He didn't think there were very many great investment opportunities, so he divested most of his partners and then started focusing on Berkshire Hathaway. And what he would do on some of the, like Berkshire Hathaway, he got rid of the management he didn't think was doing so well. He bought enough of the stock, focused all his attention. Ben Graham was one who liked diversification. Warren said, I'm going to put all my money on Berkshire Hathaway, and I'm going to increase my ownership of this company. So Berkshire Hathaway became a holding company. He purchased strong businesses he felt were undervalued. And by 1979, everything he had was in Berkshire Hathaway. They acquired See's Candy for $25 million. Another company they acquired was Geico. Another company that Berkshire Hathaway acquired was Apple Computer. That was a pretty good investment. Wells Fargo Bank, Bank of America. A more recent company they acquired, which is doing very well, is NetJets. So, and he does not have his own private jet, by the way. He owns NetJets, and he's able to fly around. He owns a good part of NetJets. He's able to fly around in jets they use. Now, just a little bit more on his frugality. One point, as I indicated, he was making $33 million per day. He still lives, as I indicated, in the same home. He pays himself now about $50,000 a year. And I think we talked about he has a late model Cadillac, only like a 2015 XRS, I think it is, only because his daughter told him, Dad, your car is embarrassing. Please get rid of that car you have. But today in Omaha, Nebraska, you can see him. He will drive to the same McDonald's every morning with his styrofoam cup full of change and pay exact cost for his breakfast. Now, look at the stock performance of Berkshire Hathaway. In 1993, the Standard & Poor's appreciated by 10%. Berkshire appreciated by 39%. 1994, Standard & Poor's increased by 1%. Berkshire did 25%. 1995, Standard & Poor's 38% increase, but Berkshire Hathaway did 57%. 1996, Berkshire Hathaway didn't do as well. The Standard & Poor's at 23, and Berkshire only at 6. Now, what was going on in the late 90s that might have caused that? Can anybody think? The tech boom. Okay, so there's a story about, there's this book starts out, and this story sort of encompasses who Warren is. In the late 90s, in fact, in 1999, there was a company called Allen Investments. And they had, every year, they had this retreat in Sun Valley. And it was for the very, very wealthy people. And they all flew into their jets to this. They all flew in their private jets to this airport. And you might find Bill Gates there, Tom Hanks, the very, very rich and famous. And it was by invitation only. And you got to go out to Sun Valley for about a week. And they had this thing down. You had full daycare for your children. You got a beautiful place to stay. They had river rafting activities. They had golf. They had all, it's a resort. And they would, all these people would meet for about a week and congregate, and they'd have various speakers come in and talk to them. Well, they talk about this particular year, Warren Buffett is on the, he jumps on the net jet, or he jumps on the private jet he has. And they talk about his family. Some of his family members came with him. He's in the jet, and he does make the stewardess feel, or the flight attendant feel comfortable. That's the one thing he does do, because she's, you know, he didn't necessarily know her. So he makes her feel comfortable. And then next thing, they've got all the snacks for their family, and they're getting ready, and they have all these big, huge chairs. They sit in this private jet, and they're flying to Idaho and from Omaha. And what is, of course, Warren, he says, she gets him his cherry Coke and his potato chips, and then for the next 2 or 3 hours, he is behind a newspaper. Nobody talks to him. That's who he is. He's got the newspaper. He's reading. And they're all having a great time. So they go to this week-long retreat, and he's the keynote speaker. And at that time, all of these tech people are there. They've some of these people from Silicon Valley, they've made a ton of money in their new businesses, and they're the newly rich people are there. So what but they're all waiting, and the talk was, you know, Warren's kind of lost it. He doesn't want any of this tech. He doesn't want any of the tech investments. He won't buy these stocks. Warren's kind of, you know, he's kind of behind the curve here. So Warren does give this speech at the end, and he basically says, look, he says, there's, in effect, there's really nothing behind your businesses. And he used this example. He says, at that time, Toys R Us was earning $400 million per year off of sales of $11 billion. And it's valued at $4.9 billion. So that's some real value. He says, there's another company came along called eToys. eToys was losing, was only selling $100 million compared to $11 billion for Toys R Us. So they're losing $123 million on sales of $100 million, and eToys had a value of $3.9 million. So a lot of people were buying eToys when they could have bought Toys R Us. And he basically said, there's no value. There's no real value here except what you think it's worth in terms of eToys. Well, Toys R Us then partnered with Amazon.com and started selling toys through the internet. And eToys eventually went into liquidation. Their CEO and their executives were very brave. They didn't sell their stock, even though it did start looking bleak. The president of eToys had a stock value in the company of $850 million. He lost all that money. eToys went into liquidation. So Warren, talking to the people, says, he says, I do have a gift bag for each of you. And he says, in the gift bag, you will find a jeweler's loop. He says, I want you to all take a close look at the diamond rings that the people sitting next to you, the diamond ring that wife is wearing. He says, it may not be real, in effect. He says, and he used that jeweler's loop to illustrate that this is all phony stuff, guys. And especially, he says, the guy next to you, if he's on a second or third wife, he says, yeah, pretty much you can guarantee her ring is going to be phony. So he didn't make a lot of friends, necessarily. But so we're going to have to, I'm about ready to wrap up here. So what contributed to his success? A good mind for numbers, a difficult childhood, uncertainty, and financial uncertainty in his family. That can create a laser-like focus on somebody who grows up with that. And he's always been extremely willing to sacrifice and delay his gratification. Now, I just want to, his philanthropy is legendary. He has taken care of his children somewhat, but he's already agreed to give away $37 billion. And he's in the process of his foundation doing that. He's partnered with Bill Gates, And he doesn't think that his children having an overabundance of money is a great thing. And so he is he's giving away all his money. Now, a few more things about him. Warren, every Sunday, one of the businesses also that Berkshire Hathaway owns is Dairy Queen. Warren takes 12 children every Sunday to Dairy Queen. And he does not email. He still plays the ukulele. And he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Now, he did have a real belief, and still does, in his own investment philosophy, which is buy value. And a couple of tips for success from Warren. A teenager one time asked him, what advice would you give a young person on how to be successful? And his response, one could debate, but it may have been, so you could say, well, this was geared to a teenager. But Warren said, in effect, it's better to hang out with people better than, he says, it's better to hang out with people better than you. Pick out associates whose behavior is better than yours, and you'll drift in that direction. And then his partner, longtime partner, Charlie Munger, piped in and he said, if this gives you a little temporary unpopularity with your peer group, to hell with them. And so his advice is, hang out with people that have integrity. Integrity is crucial for success. Never hire someone without integrity, no matter how smart they are. He said, generally, in terms of what you hire, he says, you're looking for three things generally in a person: intelligence, energy, and integrity. If they don't have the last one, don't bother with the first two. People operating with integrity can be trusted. You never have to worry about their actions or whether they're hiding from anyone. He also said, hang out with intentionally focused people that know how to say no. Buffett learned a long time ago that the greatest commodity of all is time. He simply mastered the art and practice of setting boundaries for himself. The difference between successful people and really successful people is that really successful people say no to almost everything. Hang out with people who fill their minds by reading. You want to increase your knowledge tenfold? Buffett says, become a learning machine. Now, by the way, he's 88 years old, and he still, to this day, practices what he preaches. He says, become a learning machine. So instead of coming home, sitting on the couch, and binge-watching a whole season of Mad Men or Game of Thrones, pick up a book. Buffett estimates he spends 80% of his time of his working day reading and thinking. When asked how to get smarter, Buffett once held up stacks of paper and said, read 500 pages like this every day. That's how knowledge builds up, like compound interest. And then the last thing he said was, hang out with people who are legitimately loved by others. He was once asked by a Georgia Tech student about his greatest success and greatest failure, to which he responded, when you get to my age, you'll really measure your success in life by when you get to my age, you'll really measure your success in life by how many people you want to have love you that actually do love you. How many people that you want to have love you that actually do love you? He adds, I know a lot of people who have a lot of money, but the truth is that nobody in the world loves them. That's the ultimate test of how you live your life. Buffett nails it with one final statement on the secret to being loved. The trouble with love is you can't buy it. The only way to get love is to be lovable. The more you give love away, the more you get. Okay, now, one more thing. His wife did choose another lifestyle, or another life, I should say. She moved to San Francisco in 1978. This is funny because she said, that's Susan,
She says, I want to go live in San Francisco. I'm at Omaha. I'm done with Omaha. I'll stay married to you. In fact, I'll even get some other women to help you out a little bit and do what I did. So she persuades this lady named Astrid Monks, a waitress in a coffee shop, to become close to Warren. And this lady then eventually became Warren's companion. In fact, when Warren went to the Sun River trip, when he went on this week-long vacation, his Susan, the wife, came in for the, who he was still married to, and who had been separated from him since 1978, came in and spent 3 or 4 days.
Seven?
Yes, since 1978. And then, but they've still maintained this wonderful relationship. And then Susan flew out, and Astrid, his new, and you all look kind of puzzled. And he said, Warren Buffett says, I can't tell you how it works, but it works great. Well, that's his. in some ways, the rich do live differently than us. But I wanted to. Okay, so on his. Yeah, and Susie did pass away in 2004. So in 2006, he did marry Astrid, his longtime companion. And by the way, he got set up with Astrid just because Susie, living in San Francisco, called this waitress and said, please, please. Go help Warren. Go to his house, cook him meals, do whatever, you know, just help him out. He needs somebody. And so his first wife encouraged this younger woman to become his girlfriend. And they have this little triangle. They had this little triangle that worked well. Now there's his home outside Nebraska. He still lives in it. That's a $31,000 house. So that's about it. I hope that I think that he is a great person. I think he's a very approachable guy, and he certainly has been a success. And there's a lot of great things we can learn from him. Thank you.
Why did he call him Snowball?
Talks about the fact. Let me see. Maybe I can. He talks about the. They talk about little Warren, and he had this. Okay. It is the winter of Warren's ninth year. Outside in the yard, he and his little sister Bertie are playing in the snow. Warren is catching snowflakes one at a time first. Then he is scooping them up by handfuls. He starts to pack them into a ball. As the snowball grows bigger, he places it on the ground. Slowly, it begins to roll. He gives it a push, and it picks up more snow. He pushes the snowball across the lawn, piling snow on snow. Soon he reaches the edge of the yard. After a moment of hesitation, he heads off, rolling the snowball throughout the neighborhood. And from there, Warren continues onward, casting his eye on a whole world full of snow. And they think that's the analogy, that he just has a snowball. He just keeps pushing and gets bigger and bigger. Any other questions?
Is he a loner?
He has a partner named Charlie Munger, who has been, who they've kept in touch and worked together for many, many years, I think since the late 60s.
And I heard you say he was approachable. I'm not sure either one of those answers the question.
He seems like a very down-to-earth guy. One of the things we did learn in researching this was people have paid as much as $3 million just to have lunch with him. Yeah. So he's quite an interesting guy.
One thing I don't know if I mentioned, but he has his big corporate meeting in Omaha. He does pick out top kids at Marriott School of Business and flies him to this. He does support the BYU School of Business by bringing top students from school out to his,
you know, one of, time with him. That's great. One of the, that's interesting you say. One of the things he does is he'll pay $1 million. Anybody who can predict a Sweet 16 correctly, and is in some group of people he is over, he will give $1 million to. So.
I have one comment.
Yeah.
Since we're all in business, have been in business, most of us are raising families. Interesting to know if there's a common denominator between starting a curbside business at age 6 and subsequent success. As you pointed out, we're all salespeople.
I want to point out one thing that I don't think we're taught in our culture to be this single-minded. I mean, his life for many, many years was stock reports. He would go to his kids' ball games once in a while, but he would still be reading his stock report. And he was singularly focused on making money. And he's a money-making and a learning machine. And I'm not sure that many of us probably are a little more well-balanced. Right, wrong, or different? Two or three.
Did he have a spiritual life at all?
I did not.
Detect it.
No. I didn't read about it.
Well, thank you, John. We have a little token of appreciation. Thank you all for coming. Next month, same bat time, same bat channel. Second Wednesday here, Mr. Rich Ketley will teach us how to network and how to market ourselves and our ideas, gain a bigger sphere of influence. That's kind of what we want here, is be able to take our influence, you know, these things of integrity that we're trying to learn, you know, and increase that circle so we can increase, you know, integrity and, you know, ethical leadership throughout the world. With that, have a great day.
Thank you.
Thanks. Christmas.